For me, my passion has always laid within the world of digital experience and building new experiences, trying to kind of always be at the forefront of what those experiences look like and how they're evolving. The website is the shop window versus all of our competitors, although increasingly we see that shop window starting to diversify out into other channels.
Well, how do you see that basically changing how we have to think about the website, how we have to work with the website?
This is the thing that I find kind of most interesting at the minute, and that actually keeps me awake at night the most, is thinking about what is that role in the future and, you know, what does the website become.
Before we dive in, you're listening to the Masters of Search podcast with me, your host, Niklas Buschner. Each week, I sit down with some of the smartest people around the world in SEO and AI search to bring you their strategies, mental models, and top pieces of actionable advice. If you enjoy this podcast, don't forget to like and subscribe and follow it in your favorite podcasting app or YouTube. It helps us get top-notch guests and create the best possible content for you. Let's dive into today's episode. Most conversations about AI search right now focus on visibility and rankings. My guest today is thinking about something bigger. What happens when your buyers already know everything about you before they ever visit your site, and what that means for the entire digital experience you built. James Ward is head of digital experience at Personio, one of Europe's fastest growing HR tech companies, where he leads web strategy, SEO, content, and CRO across multiple international markets. In this episode, we'll dig into what he calls quote-unquote dark AI traffic, why your own Wikipedia page might be quietly undermining your positioning, why B2B buyer expectations are about to fundamentally shift, and whether websites as we know them are heading toward becoming databases for LLM front ends. Welcome to the podcast, James.
Hey there, Niklas. Great to be here and super excited to be talking to you today.
Yeah, thanks so much. I think there's so much in it, and already from like our pre-talk, I felt like there are so many ideas I want to get your perspective on, I want to dig deeper into. But I think we have to give our listeners a little bit of your personal background. So I'd like to know, how did you end up leading digital experience at Personio?
The million-dollar question. Really ended up here as a result of working in a combination of demand generation, broader digital marketing, and web products ownership for kind of 12 or more years. And for me, my passion has always laid within the world of digital experience and building new experiences, trying to kind of always be at the forefront of what those experiences look like and how they're evolving. And, you know, for me, joining Personio was a pivot away from some of the much larger organizations that I'd worked with historically. So, you know, I came from Salesforce prior to Personio, and I've worked for large kind of billion-dollar organizations like ADP, who pay one in 10 Americans. So it's really a shift into a business where there's much more speed, there's much more autonomy, and we can do much more experimentation and move much faster, which obviously given the state of play of today, and particularly with the rise of AI, is exactly where we all need to be and where we all need to be thinking.
And would you agree that the digital experience title is fairly new? Because I checked on LinkedIn how much head of digital experience there are, and I couldn't find like that many. So can you give us a little bit about like what digital experience? So obviously everybody can do something with the words, but like what's the concept behind it?
Yeah, so it's I would say fairly new within the B2B space, but actually it's a term that's been around a little bit more in the B2C world for a while now, where it's more encompassing of connected experiences across areas like web, the various different kind of inbound motions, be it kind of through funnel, basket kind of conversion, be it through chat experiences and a number of different areas. And the reason for that change within my role was really because as we think about how the experience is evolving, how the website is evolving, the role that the website plays, how, you know, buyers are increasingly more aware and are turning to AI and are turning to other channels to start to do a lot of that research before they even hit your website. It has a bearing on how we want to then build out what that experience looks like in the future. So, you know, I didn't want us to be stuck in the world of just thinking about a website, because actually for me, for my team, we need to be thinking much more broadly than that. So it's more to shape us for the future of what's coming next.
Then let's tap into this topic already, the website topic. So how important is the website still for Personio today? And what do you think, how important will the website be in the future?
Incredibly important. You know, for us, it's still our biggest growth lever. The website is the shop window versus all of our competitors, although increasingly we see that shop window starting to diversify out into other channels. You know, there's a lot of other channels now that buyers are able to, or prospective buyers are able to go to before they reach our website. So still very, very important, still very much the source of truth for how we want to represent ourselves and talk about ourselves in the market as well. So in terms of, you know, future importance, I don't see that changing. If anything, I see the website becoming increasingly important, even if the role of that website changes.
And what do you think, how will it change with basically LLMs or AI chatbots being maybe more and more of a go-to interface that people interact with, and then the LLM or like the retrieval mechanism pulls content from the website? So how do you see that basically changing how we have to think about the website, how we have to work with the website?
Yeah, this is the thing that I find kind of, you know, most interesting at the minute, and that actually keeps me awake at night the most is thinking about what is that role in the future, and you know, what does the website become? And you know, if I think about even the shift and the evolution that we're seeing in a lot of sites now, where you know it's becoming the norm to see a prompt box on homepages where people are, you know, straight away jumping into building. I think we're naturally starting to see rises in things like AI chatbots. We're seeing rises in LLMs and their ability to do agentic browsing on our behalf as well. So naturally then thinking about what that means for the website experience and user expectations when they come to the website, for me means that we've got to start thinking about how those user expectations are evolving and what we then have to build for that. So, you know, do we still push users through a curated path? Do things like a website navigation need to exist in the future, or actually do we lean more into kind of prompt-based searching and more heavily into search? Is there a world where we should be getting much more personalized and providing a much deeper level of personalization to the user outside of just, you know, the kind of typical playbook of B2B SaaS, which is we're going to build some pages, we're going to build some gated assets, we're going to point you to a product page and ultimately hope that you fill in a request form for a demo. There naturally are ways that we should be thinking about how we curate that experience much more heavily. And you see it now even in even more heavily in the B2C world. You know, Spotify have just launched the ability to do prompt-based personalization as well. And that is going to become the norm. That's what people are going to become used to. And we see search queries on Google expanding, and the type of queries people are searching for are much deeper. There's much more kind of depth generally to that content discovery. So we have to be prepared for that, and we have to be able to curate that content to facilitate that as well.
And do you think there are things we have to unlearn when we think about the website experience? So if I'm thinking about SEO, what we had to unlearn was basically over-focusing on keywords, and like keywords being the predominant factor for ranking, and then we moved to topical coverage, etc. Now, obviously, there are other changes with AI search, but do you think that we have to unlearn principles like how we design and how we basically conceptualize a website? So I was thinking, maybe it's a stupid idea, but do we maybe have to write content in Markdown in the future if an agent is the like from now we look at the traffic split by mobile, desktop, tablet, and then in the future we look at the traffic split by agent and human, and the agent can understand Markdown better. So can you give me a little bit of your thinking about stuff that might have held true the longest and that we might have to unlearn for the future?
If you're thinking about the immediate term, SEO and conventional SEO, I don't think is going anywhere, right? Like still proportionally, if you look across the split of LLM traffic versus conventional SEO traffic and your Googles of the world, like it's still heavily biased in conventional SEO, obviously. But with that, naturally, yeah, you know, I think comes a shift in terms of the type of content, and as I mentioned, you know, the depth of content that we have to curate and think about, but also not just the content on site, but the content that exists off site. And quite often in the traditional SEO world, that's been limited to things like backlinking and being able to make sure that we can secure links back from high domain authority websites. Whereas now we should be thinking much more about SEO holistically. So how are we showing up in search generally? Not necessarily how are we showing up in search for our website and for our specific domain. So that encompasses things like listicle websites and third-party review sites and even our Wikipedia pages, as you alluded to earlier, right? I think there's a real need to think more holistically about SEO and content optimization across the board. I would then also say, to your point around keywords, definitely, you know, starting to shift away from just pure play conventional keyword targeting to also look at how we can focus more specifically on that kind of interconnected network of topic clustered content around particular focus areas. And that again could encompass one specific page, it could encompass multiple pages, but it probably also covers areas that maybe you wouldn't have considered previously. So things like the About Us section of your website or your press release pages or some of the kind of legacy content that exists on your site that might actually be negatively impacting your SEO and your LLM visibility now. So things like content pruning, increasingly important, being able to make sure that the narrative that we spin across all of those different pages tells the same story. You know, if you're talking to the smaller end of the market and your website proposition doesn't all reflect that, then you're going to confuse SEO, you're going to confuse your LLM. So you just have to think more holistically about how all of those things stitch together.
Speaking of brand narrative or like narratives in general or messaging, I think it's a fundamental shift where if someone was, for example, using Google or whatever search engine, they were searching for something and they were coming to our site, we basically had full control over what they see and the messaging we use. Now you have this layer before that, which could be AI overview on Google, which could be AI mode, which could be ChatGPT, where it's basically a curated response based on the own content that we have on our site and based on third-party sites. So how do you think about that? Have you significantly shifted resources, being time, people, tooling, whatever, towards third-party sites? And how do you, what can you share about how you approach it specifically?
Yeah, so I, you know, just coming back to that point I made earlier around that holistic view, be it on-site or off-site, I think firstly it comes with starting with trying to understand what that perception is. And sometimes, you know, yes, there are tools out there that can help with this, the kind of Peaks, the Profounds, et cetera, of the world. But the most logical starting point, and actually a lot of where we started, was through reverse prompting and through trying to kind of go through those LLMs and go through the Google search platforms to understand if we search for X, so ultimately, you know, how we want to be perceived, what is the result that comes up, who are the people that are coming up, and what are the cited sources that are coming up. And that's where you uncover then some of those areas that perhaps you would have overlooked previously. So I mentioned, you know, the legacy press releases or the legacy Wikipedia pages, etc., that refer to you in a particular way. And I think from there, then you get a good sense of, okay, so how are we being perceived versus how we want to be perceived? And then from there, it's about, as you say, just aligning that focus and that resource to try and bridge some of those gaps. So we absolutely are looking into more of the kind of offsite work and representation than previously. Things like Wikipedia pages probably would have been left to perhaps a brand team or an internal comms team kind of in days gone by, but now is part of our overall content strategy. If we think about the offsite review websites, although they've always been important, the quality of those reviews, the types of reviews that we're capturing, all paint a picture for us. So that's increasingly important also. We even, you know, looked at doing experimentation with things like Reddit communities in some of the early days as well, when everybody jumped on that bandwagon and suddenly Reddit was full of kind of spam from AI. But that in and of itself was another learning. So I think, you know, always just trying to learn, always trying to test new mechanisms. But the other thing to note is that the results change daily, literally daily. Like we've monitored the same sort of prompts and the responses that come up in Google AI overviews, for example, and it can change on a daily basis. So you're always having to learn and test and optimize. And I think that's another shift from days of SEO optimizations, a kind of AEO optimization now, is that you change something and an LLM can pick it up instantly. Whereas, you know, previously you used to submit a page for indexing to Google and then sit and monitor SEM Rush obsessively in Search Console to see whether it had been picked up and whether you'd had the traction that you wanted. Whereas now you can almost see some of that overnight. So the learnings are much, much higher proportionally, which is obviously great for us.
And can you share some specifics about the Wikipedia discovery? Because this I already found intriguing when we talked before we hit the record button.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. So I think the thing that was really interesting for us there was that, depending on some of the markets that you searched in, some of the LLM perception of Personio was that, you know, we were geared up to serve the smaller end of the market, so very much for SMBs. But the reality is that, you know, we actually serve much broader businesses than that. Our sweet spot and our core ICP is actually within the mid-market typically. And a lot of the reason for that perception within the LLM platforms was because of one line within our Wikipedia page. So there's a few things there that we took as learnings just in terms of that perception. But then also when you think about how that kind of correlates across some of the other types of pages that you may have out there, or that people may have created that are talking about you, be it comparison websites, the dreaded competitor comparisons or listicles as well. All of that content is being used to shape how LLMs perceive you. So it could only take one competitive article or one third-party listicle to say, you know, X brand is designed for X part of the market to undo a lot of your broader strategy, particularly if it's a publication that's held in high regard. So it's really important to, again, you know, kind of look holistically at how you're being cited and referenced by a lot of those other third parties as well.
Now, Wikipedia is obviously a super sensitive topic because it has gained a very good reputation that also led to it being fed into the training data of LLMs due to the moderation and due to the whole like community-led approach that not everybody can just go to the platform and just say what they want to have said about themselves. So how did you approach it? Like, were you looking for other sources that you could reference that would like balance the line more? Or can you share something about if maybe people are listening that also operate in bigger businesses like Personio, and they have Wikipedia pages and they might have also a legacy or some sort of like untrue perception that is shaped by that?
Yeah, I think, you know, you just touched on it there. Wikipedia is obviously it's a channel where they've built their trust in for the most part authenticity and impartiality. So you have to maintain that. You know, you can't just turn it into a kind of sales listing page with a load of marketing content. It has to be factual, and it has to be factually based, and then reference back to cited sources. So you know, that's typically what you can do, and you can point to things like, you know, even some of your own press releases, for example, as cited sources to talk to that credibility and maximize the credibility of the points that you're making. It's still all subject for review. You know, typically it's actually better to get a third party or someone impartial to submit those responses for you, because it is all heavily moderated by third parties. So I think that's a good thing, because ultimately it stops, as you say, everybody just going out and being able to build whatever type of content they want to sit on Wikipedia. But yeah, generally speaking, being able to reference some of those existing cited sources you've got, if you've done internal research, or if you've got published white papers and reports that talk to any of the points or claims that you're trying to make, as I say, press releases, all of that sort of information that's publicly visible, are all things that you can use to ultimately corroborate the points that you're trying to make in there.
Now let's look at the perspective of the buyers a little bit more, because we thought about the AI overviews and the ChatGPT responses, basically making it, I would say, maybe more challenging, or at least more like you have to spend a little bit more time on thinking about how to shape your brand narrative, because it's not just what I say on my site is the truth and nothing but the truth, so to say. But looking at it from the buyer perspective, it's also a window into even more information being compiled for me. So how do you think about how that will change basically the expectations and also the behavior of buyers in their research journey?
Yeah, so I think the biggest change, and I see it even in myself, is the expectation around speed and as I mentioned before, depth of content is much, much higher now. You know, you don't want to, when you can go as deep as you can in an LLM platform, that starts to outweigh, you know, conventional personalization channels. And, you know, historically you would need to look at intent data, and you'd use a personalization engine to kind of guess or infer a certain degree of understanding about a buyer, and then you would tailor their experience accordingly. Whereas now they have the ability to do a lot of that for themselves. And I think to then land on a website where, having done some of their research, to then land on a site where ultimately, you know, you've got a very pre-formed, preconceived kind of journey for them that you're trying to map out. I think those two things can kind of clash quite heavily, especially when then, you know, in the SaaS space, for example, if people want to see the product, if they want to see things like pricing, if they want to kind of get into that level of detail, and that's all hidden, and it's hidden behind a typical kind of B2B SaaS product flow, then I think that can become a challenge. But even more broadly, I think you have to kind of now understand that a lot of that buyer research is, or prospective buyer research is, done in those LLMs before they even reach your website. So being able to influence that as best you can means that the type of content that you're creating needs to evolve as well. So I mentioned even things like pricing there, being able to make sure that pricing information potentially is displayed for, or with is surfaced within those LLM platforms, that's not being provided by a third party or by someone other than yourself, that all of the information that you're giving all the way through the funnel is completely accurate, and that ideally you're the source of truth for all of that information. I think you kind of have to accept that naturally we will start to see, you know, a diminishing top of funnel, where some of the traffic that's coming to the website is, certainly that would have been in that research or that very early research stage historically, is now probably not going to come to your website anymore. It's all going to happen in the LLM platform, right? So naturally that means then that you're starting to gear your website up to be even more of a direct conversion engine in some places, looking at how can you overcome the objections, how can you make sure that the information that they need to make the decision is much more visible, much more quickly.
When I think about how basically the whole digital buying experience changes now, I'm oftentimes reminded of how the offline buying experience changed, where people that have walked into a store basically 10 years ago, maybe looked around a little bit, went to the person that offers consulting there and said, hey, you know, I want to buy this, I want to buy that, do you have some recommendations? Whereas now, at least people that are a little bit tech savvy, they go heavily pre-informed. They go to the shop, they already know what they want. It's just a matter of, do you have it in stock? Or like, can you basically deliver it to me, or whatever questions people have. Do you also see this analogy, and like also from that point, what do you think we could learn maybe from retail? Because retail has already experienced that for quite some time before it came to digital.
Yeah, that's a great analogy. And I absolutely believe that we're at that inflection point again. For me, that inflection is, does everything at some point natively start to make sense to happen in an LLM? So, you know, to your point, do we get to a world where, I don't know, eventually maybe we're just all providing databases of information to plug into an LLM platform, and everything is surfaced within that within that sort of experience. I think even if you look to like Baidu, for example, and WeChat and some of the platforms that exist out of APAC, like generally they've been in much more of that kind of heavily personalized world for a while, where, you know, a lot of their research happens in one platform. And I feel like we're more and more kind of heading towards that sort of reality where, yeah, why does someone need to go to 10 different shop windows or websites if they can do it all from one place? You see rises of things like Claude Cowork and, you know, agentic experiences where people can effectively build out their own personal assistants to run their lives, right? Like, I mean, even I use agent mode to do my food shopping for me, and why would I need to go to some of the websites in the future? I think the thing that is still is still important and that users still need is they still like that human component, and I think they still want to be able to tangibly see the thing that they want to buy, particularly when it comes to software. And, you know, I'm speaking purely to the SaaS space at the moment, but, you know, SaaS is complex for a lot of businesses, particularly larger organizations with complex requirements. You can't necessarily just buy a new software solution on the basis of a quick demo. Like, ultimately, you know, you need to dig into that in a lot more detail, but I still believe that a lot of that could happen in LLM platforms natively, which, yeah, to your point, yeah, cuts out a lot of the kind of high street browsing as it would have existed previously.
And do you see people actually booking a demo at Personio within the ChatGPT interface? So not just asking for what's the best HR platform, etc. Then obviously Personio shows up, and then clicking to the site or searching for Personio and then going to the site, but actually completing the conversion within ChatGPT anytime soon.
I mean, who knows? But, you know, ultimately, why not? Yeah, you know, why would they not do that, or why could that not happen? I think there's the missing part, or the gap there, I think, would be that they often want to see it before they try. So, you know, that's not a long way away. We're certainly not a million miles off that level of kind of integration into LLMs like ChatGPT, etc. So, yeah, I can see that being pretty viable. You might even end up with things like, I don't know, marketplaces or whatnot built into those LLMs directly or natively, where people are, as I say, feeding some of that information, and then it's getting served up. Right? I think it's a really, really interesting space at the minute. Like, there's no telling where these things will get to, but I think part of the barrier to that will be just native adoption of LLMs. You know, I don't have a good sense at the minute of what current LLM adoption rates look like across different core parts of our audience, or certainly within kind of, you know, B2B SaaS companies, how heavily they're leaning into some of these things. But that gap is only gonna narrow over the next 12 to 18 months or so. I know, like, the vast majority of people I speak to now do a lot of their early research within those LLM platforms, so I can fully see that becoming a reality at some point.
And do you also feel like that SEO, or now GEO, AEO, all of that, used to be more like a performance or like tech play, where you were looking for like the latest hack and the latest edge and how you could maybe in a way trick the algorithm, to now the whole space becoming more like brand aware? So we have to think about how a certain company is perceived across multiple sources. We have to shape the narrative. I feel like, just if I look at the conversations that are happening around the topic, it's much less about, or at least from it's my personal perspective, it's much less about there's this one technical thing and there's like the keyword density and this and that, and there's more like brand narrative and like third party sites and like review sites and all of that. So what's your perspective on that?
Yeah, it's almost, it kind of it's blended a few different worlds that perhaps would have been more disconnected previously, right? So to your point, I think brand perception, reputation management, but also conventional kind of SEO and content strategy are all overlapping a lot more heavily than they did previously. I think naturally there are still hacks out there, and there are still things that are happening to try and kind of hack the algorithm, because it is still changing rapidly. But naturally, you know, I've kind of seen a lot of those, even if there are immediate kind of spikes as a result of some of those hacks, they soon get leveled out again longer term. So I think being able to more heavily now align across areas like brand, conventional SEO, AEO, I think tech SEO and optimization is still super important. Just maybe we've probably dialed up in some slightly different areas there. So, you know, previously it would have been making sure that a lot of tech health was in order. Now it's more, okay, are we using the right structured data? Is schema markup being used effectively? To your earlier point, should we be testing, you know, markdown specifically for LLMs and specific crawl, looking at crawl paths that LLMs are taking across the website and some of that sort of stuff. So I don't think anything that we were doing historically or anyone really has been doing historically has gone away per se. I just think there's been much more of an upweighting now into content delivery and strategy. And as I say, kind of that offsite content strategy has probably evolved more than anything else at the moment, because it's so important.
We obviously touched already a lot on AI as a channel, especially like AI search, but you also mentioned AI as a tool, for example, for yourself, like where you do grocery shopping with agent mode, which is obviously something that makes a lot of sense. Sometimes when I get home from work and I want to make a nice dinner for my daughter and for my wife, I feel like, oh, damn, someone should have shopped some fresh produce. So this could be something that AI definitely helps with. Unfortunately, it's still hard in the physical world. But anyway, we're drifting off. One of the obvious use cases also in marketing when it comes to using AI as a tool is content generation. This is something that I think also was one of the earliest things. We used it for either drafting this like email campaign, newsletter thing. We maybe used it for drafting like a poem or something. Some things work better, some things work not so well. So I'd like to get your take on AI-generated content. So do you think it's basically something that we shouldn't lean into, you shouldn't use, or you think it's something that is definitely, that has to be part of the future marketing org?
You know, I think it absolutely has its place, and ultimately I do believe it should ultimately be part of the future of a marketing org. I think it comes with a heavy caveat that it still has to follow all of the kind of conventional I guess rules around good content creation. It needs to be authentic, it needs to be trustworthy, it's got to have the right signals for it to be valuable for a real person as well as an LLM. And I think you can get to a point with AI, but a lot of it depends on how well trained your AI is. And, you know, ultimately some people will lean into just jumping straight into ChatGPT and trying to generate a blog post or an article or a listicle or whatever it may be, and they fed it very little source material, so it churns out and regurgitates a lot of the stuff that already exists in the market. If you're plugging in a lot of your own data, your own sources, your conversations with your kind of, I don't know, any learnings you can take from conversations with your customers potentially, to your own case studies, your research, your brand tone of voice and guidelines, like previous examples of content that you've created, over time, like, it will become much more intelligent, and the quality of output will become much stronger as well. And I think that's where it really helps with speed of execution, particularly in the world of AEO, where, you know, you want to be able to spin up tweaks and changes to content that previously would have had to have gone through some crazy workflow. Like, ideally, you should be in a position where you can identify what some of those areas should be, the content gaps, and like within 20 minutes, it's built on your website and it's updated and live, right? Like, that's the future. But it has to still be relevant and of high quality. And I think there's a lot of stuff that's out there at the minute that doesn't solve for that gap. You know, typically you see that any of that kind of slop content that gets spun up very, very quickly may have an immediate ranking benefit, or may have an immediate benefit in terms of kind of citation in LLMs, but then that soon drops off afterwards. Like, I've seen numerous examples of where that's happened.
And why do you think that is, that so many people still do the content with AI that is not fed with a lot of context and not fed with actual customer conversations and everything you just mentioned? Like, you just described exactly how you should do it. And still, I see a lot of people, and also when I check sites, when I look at the content that is actually on these sites, I can really feel, I can smell the slop. So why does it still happen? Because, I mean, the models that are available to all of us, they are so powerful now. GPT 5.3, 5.4, Claude, Sonnet 4.6, Opus 4.6. These are super powerful models that everybody can access basically with a 10 euro or 20 euro subscription a month. So it's not a financial issue, obviously.
No, and I think there's probably numerous reasons for it, but it could be, in some cases, it could be, you know, people that are relatively early on that AI maturity curve generally, wanting to get involved and wanting to try something new and test something, but not necessarily having all of the broader context around, you know, what does that actually mean? What does good content versus kind of AI slop look like? Maybe they're putting too much trust in what the AI is coming back with and not realizing that it's probably built off, you know, 10 of the same bits of content that already exist out in the market at the moment. So I think that's a factor. I think in a similar vein, obviously the level of integration that you can do within some of these tools is organization dependent. Like, there's a lot of companies I speak to, even very large, very tech focused organizations that are, I would say, kind of laggards in terms of AI adoption ultimately. So they don't have the integrations, they don't have the data sources. There's more of a kind of trust issue around AI generally. So naturally, what they're feeding it is not going to create as powerful a model for them to be able to leverage as well. So I think those are a couple of areas. And then, you know, the other might just be the kind of pursuit of speed ultimately, and wanting to, feeling the pressure and the urgency of, you know, we need to do AI stuff. And, you know, that's probably something that's echoed within their companies as well, as their organizations are looking around at other companies that are talking about AI. You see the echo chamber on LinkedIn of everybody now that is an AI expert. So there's naturally this kind of almost unspoken peer pressure of everybody looking at the world of AI and thinking, you know, damn, I need to do some stuff and show that we're using AI. So I'm going to create some AI articles and I'm going to get them out there as quickly as possible and see what happens. So I think that naturally is still happening. And I think that, you know, the more mature companies when it comes to AI usage and adoption have probably, they've already been through that learning experience and come out the other side. So now are starting to refine the content models, whereas there are probably some that are still earlier in that journey at the minute that are still figuring that out for themselves ultimately.
And what would you say, how can people build more resilience against that outside pressure? Because I talked to, like, from junior to head of to director to C-level, and nobody is immune to that. So there are individual people, some are more, some are less, but what would you say, because obviously being just driven by every next LinkedIn post is not a good strategy, but still, I think a lot of people can relate to that. Damn, maybe I should look into Cowork more. Maybe I should build something with Cloud Code. Maybe I should do that. Maybe I should do that. But then you look at your schedule and you only see so much time being free. So what can you share maybe also from your personal experience on what people can do around building more resilience?
Yeah, I think you know, a lot of it comes down to, in some cases, the individual, right? But also, just generally speaking, I would say having curiosity, so, you know, wanting to kind of go out there and understand this of their own volition before it gets to a point where there's a LinkedIn post that pops up and they're like, oh, you know, damn it, I need to do that, or before their C-suite or somebody else sees that LinkedIn post, I think is important. I think if you're learning and you're experimenting for yourself, then you can get ahead of a lot of those things. And I think truly think about what the problems are that you actually want to solve with AI, as opposed to what is the AI that we want to try and get to solve a problem, if that makes sense. Like, I think ultimately you will know, or you should be able to kind of know within your team, your organization, your company, or even in your personal life, like, what are some of those things that I think I could use AI for, that would benefit me, that would save me time, that would automate and reduce a lot of the manual work or pressure, etc. And I think that's where then you can start to do more of that learning, and then you take the learning and you can build on that ultimately. But I think just when it comes to kind of broader pressures, I think trying to be ahead of that curve, spend time experimenting, even just in your personal life, realize some of the value, and yeah, try not to get too distracted by the noise that's out there. Just focus on what are the key problems that you actually want to solve using AI.
And how do you think about, like, the marketing org of the future? Because I see more and more conversations going around, do we still need junior roles? Because we can use AI for that, we can deploy agents, etc. And I mean, obviously, also in your role, looking at your team, maybe also looking at other teams and Personio, or other teams that you talk to or that you look at. What would you say, what still holds true for the future about what we learned, what makes a strong marketing org? And what would you say, what are, like, the biggest changes that are happening currently?
Yeah, I would say it's kind of very, very high level, and without going into too many specifics, I think ultimately for me it would be that it's just a change or an evolution in terms of everybody's role ultimately. And, you know, what I mean by that is that I feel like naturally marketing's kind of gone through this shift over the past 10 years or more anyway, where we've seen rises in we've seen kind of falls in areas where previously, you know, everybody was more of a T-shaped marketer. I remember when I first started out, the digital marketer at the time was responsible for everything from website optimization through to performance media to campaign builds, like a whole host of different things. And then naturally over time, a lot of roles have become much more specialized. And I think naturally now what we've found is that AI helps to smooth out some of that experience layer a little bit, to the point that, you know, people are starting to become a lot more T-shaped again. Suddenly you've got people that had great ideas that are able to prototype and bring those ideas to life. You've got people that weren't content writers that now can be more content writers. You've got people that previously weren't analytical that are able to be much more analytical now because they can use AI to help them with that. So I don't see there necessarily being a shift of, you know, do we need to remove junior roles or do we need to remove certain roles? I think it's probably more a case of just everybody's on, again, that maturity curve of AI adoption and the level of kind of T-shaped marketer that they're able to be. So I don't know, maybe we end up with slightly less silos or kind of typical sub-teams within marketing, and actually perhaps everybody's just a little bit more kind of project or particular area of focus aligned, but actually they can own a much broader remit or scope within their own world. Who knows? Not sure just yet.
And do you think everybody has to become a coder with Codex or a Claude Code?
I don't think everybody has to be, but I think everybody should be. I think, you know.
Okay.
Yeah.
Even the content writer?
Yeah, I think so. I think I think everybody can really kind of benefit from building and shipping and learning and kind of understanding what that's like and what that feels like. And, you know, again, not even necessarily in a business context, in their own personal life, like being able to bring something to life that exists in your mind that, you know, you want to kind of build tangibly is is super rewarding. And there's a lot of people that perhaps, you know, have not been able to do that previously. So I think going through that experience and building something and just kind of learning more about that process and even using it as a tool to bring any idea that you have to life. Like the amount of times, like even I've used kind of Claude Code or I've used Lovable or whatever else just to articulate a vision around something or to skip building a slide deck and build an interactive kind of, you know, report or dashboard or whatever it might be is it's a godsend. Like it's so helpful. It doesn't mean that everything that you build has to be something that you take and you ship directly. Like sometimes it's just a better way of visualizing something and bringing your idea to life. Like we even have been playing around with shipping from or prototyping much more heavily in code as opposed to doing all of our prototyping in Figma, for example, which just helps us jump straight to, okay, so what are the actual functional requirements? What's the behavior? Like, how does that feel? What does the experience feel like outside of having to build a lot of that stuff in Figma? So I think there's a lot of use cases across every department and role that could benefit from coding more broadly.
So really the I think Lovable has this mission that basically everybody can be a creator and like AI is your creativity enabler, so to say. Mm-hmm. Would you agree to that?
Yeah, I would. Yeah, definitely. I mean, you still need to be able to kind of think what is the thing that I want to build. I still don't believe that any of the tools out there are truly production ready in any capacity just yet. I think that will come eventually, but I don't think they are at the moment. But it does mean that, yeah, everybody can be a builder. Everybody can come up with something or bring that idea to life. That, you know, it's so common that you have a conversation with a friend or a colleague and they say, oh, I've got this great idea that I wish I'd shipped, or I thought of that idea and I wish I'd created it because somebody else has done it now and that's where this company has come from. And it doesn't solve for all of that, but it certainly helps people take a step in the right direction.
Okay, that's very interesting. And I would like to get your thoughts on something that I have been pondering a little bit over the last weeks and months, because I feel like, I mean, AI and creativity, a lot of people are skeptical about that two words in the same sentence. But I actually felt like that a lot of people in like the corporate world, so to say, have been, so we tell people to think outside of the box, but actually we don't really want them to think outside of the box. We wanted them to do their job and do it as quickly as possible. Now, I also feel like, and when I look at my own team at Radiant, I feel like the more they experienced what AI enables them to do, and exactly to your point, you have an idea and you see that you can bring it to life, the more you train that muscle of creating ideas, of not limiting your creativity. And I had the same experience very early in my career when I was building websites for people. I always felt like, okay, I cannot propose something that I cannot build. And I limited myself heavily. And then at some point, it was 2014, so way before I just made the switch. I felt like you cannot limit yourself to what you're able to build just today. You have to propose what is best and then figure out how to build it afterwards. So do you feel like that makes sense in any way, what I just said? And
yeah,
like,
yeah,
is no, this something where people just have to build the muscle? Like we have to build the visionary muscle a little bit more again?
Yeah, it definitely resonates, because I think there's probably a lot of people out there that think about they have those ideas, you know, be it for a campaign, be it for a campaign landing page, a brand campaign, whatever else it might be. Like there's always a lot of creativity that exists, but the barriers that pop up are probably, oh, is that going to be too much work for the team? Is it going to cost too much money? Is it going to require too much extra budget? Is it something that the team don't have capacity to support on? Therefore, what's the point of even suggesting it? I'm not going to bother. And it just stays in their notebook. So I think that's the thing that this helps to overcome. And, you know, we see some great examples of it, even within Personio, where people that have had these ideas in their minds have been able to jump into Claude Code or prototype something up and share it out across the team. And actually people are like, damn, yeah, that's great. Yeah, let's build it. Let's focus on doing it. And I think that's the thing that is really, really powerful about these tools. I mean, don't get me wrong, it can potentially become chaotic in the future if you end up in a world where suddenly everybody in the company is prototyping stuff that they want to build, right? But I still don't think having those ideas flying around is a bad thing, as long as you can actually operationalize it and you can bring them to life, which is often the blocker. But yeah, I still think it helps to build that creative muscle in people. It helps them kind of, as you say, start to think more about, okay, great, yeah, I can build that thing. And then once they've seen it, they think about, okay, what's the next evolution? And it just, yeah, helps everybody become more of a creator, which particularly in the world of kind of marketing and web and digital is something that everybody enjoys doing, and ultimately is why everybody got into the business in the first place.
Yeah, I don't want to switch seats with a head of engineering, because I cannot imagine the amount of commits and pull requests, etc., on GitHub that you get if everybody in the engineering org goes to Claude Code or Codex and they can just like bump out 10x the code in the same time. Even we, if we do a little bit of like internal tooling and we have to coordinate between two, three people. Obviously, we're not engineers, but this already feels like on the edge of being genius and being madness. So
yeah, and like I think the exciting prospect there is that, so as it stands at the minute, I agree. I think that probably causes some pain, particularly as a lot of the quality of code is not necessarily up to standard, and you've got considerations around, you know, kind of security and broader integration into tech stack and things like that. But again, you know, if you just look forward to the not too distant future and being able to make sure that, you know, there's nothing to stop you building an agent that is trained on your code base, that's integrated into your web CMS or whatever else, such that you can give people the autonomy to build things, prototype things, but just done within the constraints of your own code base ultimately, and your own integrations and pool. So you move away from someone building something in Lovable and sending it to your engineering team going, please can you build this thing for me, to then having to then completely rebuild it from scratch to ultimately someone that can build up, or certainly kind of, you know, get something very heavily in the right direction of something they want to build that exists based on the code base that already is there. So I do think it's an exciting time.
Let's tap into one aspect of SEO AI search before we wrap up the conversation a little bit, which is basically how to balance the investment, being it money, time, people on the team, between these two, like between SEO and between AI search. And I mean, even how to differentiate, should we keep doing what we did for SEO? Should we completely lean into AI search, etc.? So how do you balance that in your team at Personio?
Yeah, I think that the balance for us really is, or the common layer that spans both of those things, is content and good quality content, right? So that for us is where it's important for us to be making some of that investment. You know, SEO strategy, AEO strategy, both very, very, very heavily aligned. The tooling then that's deployed to kind of monitor across those different things to make sure that you can make the right decisions, equally important. But all of that falls over if you don't have the people to actually write and create the content. And to our earlier point, yes, you can do some of that using AI, but you still need to bake in things like, you know, deep localization and get supermarket specific and work very closely with obviously your kind of regional teams in certainly our instance, but your product marketers, your subject matter experts internally. So having strong content creators and coordinators that can help with that is kind of the key area, and certainly where we're, as I say, investing some of that time. And then you know, AI that wraps around all of that as well is the other area. So we're very focused on like how can we streamline that content, those content operations using AI as much as possible. How can we potentially explore bringing that AI content generation to life in a way where it is trained, it is kind of fully ramped on all of the different content data points that we have or sources, so that we can build it and ship it in kind of hours, not in days or weeks or months, generally speaking. But content's at the heart of all of it, for sure.
And if you look at the different things that have entered the conversation, so to say, around AI search, so one thing you mentioned earlier, also Reddit community engagement, if you want to call it like that. And then on the other hand, something like, I mean, there are lots of things, but just to give two examples, thinking about third-party mentions more, like news outlets that mention you, stories that you can basically push there. What do you think are things that are just temporarily hyped and things that have come to stay?
Good question. Yeah, so I would say that there's been a lot of hype around, as you know, and as you just mentioned, certainly some of the community sites like Reddit, and we saw that very early on, that everybody suddenly downed tools and their content strategy evolved into how can we spam the comment threads in Reddit as much as possible. I do think that's already peaked, and yes, you still see Reddit cited pretty readily, but I would say some of that community management aspect is probably the biggest hype that has now kind of shifted into some of the more conventional on-site content strategy work. Like, I'm seeing that the content that you create on your own website now, if it's created well, has a bigger influence and a bigger bearing than some of those third parties now, depending on the channel. I think Google still leans quite heavily into Reddit, particularly with AI overviews, but certainly a lot of the chat GPTs and stuff like lean more into first party sources, I've found. So I would say that aspect is probably one that is less immediately critical, although we are still working on making sure that areas like social and some of those channels get the adequate engagement. But I would say areas like review sites and third-party websites are still very, very much important and key. And there's two approaches to that. One is that you can counter some of the content that's created there and use that within your own website, or you can go and obviously influence that that content as it exists on the third-party sites that are out there at the minute. But yeah, those are the main takeaways, I would say.
And based on that, would you also say that improving and maybe also like adjusting the strategy around the content you have on your own site, that this was, at least until now, the biggest lever you have pulled for your AI search visibility?
Yeah, I still would say it's the biggest lever. But I definitely find that, you know, our own website content has the biggest bearing on our visibility within our particular industry. That may vary across different industries, but for us, it's the biggest lever. And that's what I kind of meant about, you know, being able to counter some of the content that exists out there at the minute, is that an example might be that there's a third party listicle website that is talking about, I don't know, Personio, and that we're a perfect solution for small businesses in Germany only, for example. And to counter that, we're able to create content that actually talks to our presence in other markets, that talks to the scale that we operate in, and the fact that we obviously have a large number of customers within the mid-market and enterprise as well, just as an example. So those sorts of things then mean that naturally you're able to kind of counter some of that preconception that the LLMs have about you. But that said, you know, the other angle is you'd go and partner with whoever the owner of that particular listicle is, and you'd get it updated at that source as well. And then you've got two places where that's being referenced. So that's the kind of typical approach.
Now, we always want to make this podcast as actionable as possible, and I think we already delivered on that promise. But if a fellow marketing leader came to you, or listened to this podcast right now and said, hey, we need to get serious about AI search. I feel like we are missing out there. What would you tell them to do first?
I would actually say block out, depending on the level of kind of research or work that you've already done, even if you've got no tooling, you've got no AI search tools, search monitoring tools as it stands, block out half a day or a couple of hours and spend time reverse prompting within some of those LLM platforms to understand how you're being perceived. So what I mean by that is pretend you're one of your customers and go and perform a number of different searches of things that you think your customers would be searching for and see what shows up. And when you see what shows up, ask, why did you choose those things? Like, why did you pick those companies as listings? And then if you're not in the list, ask why is my company not in that list? And it will give you some really kind of insightful information. You can even then ask it, what did you use as the cited sources for that information? And that gives you an immediate sense then of, you know, what are those offsite or on-site bits of content that may be doing you harm or maybe causing you an issue. And from there, you can do some really actionable next steps without needing to go and invest in an LLM platform.
Okay, nice. I think that's definitely some solid piece of advice. Now, I have a final question that I always ask that I bluntly stole from Lenny's podcast, who is a significantly better podcast host than I am. So if I ever come close to him, I could retire. But my question is, what didn't we talk about that we should have talked about?
Oh, that's a good question.
Thanks to Lenny.
Thank you, Lenny. I would say that, you know, the thing that we probably could talk about more is, or should have talked about a little bit more, is maybe measurement of all of this stuff, right? So I think measurement is a question that a lot of marketers get asked around LLM visibility in particular and AEO at the moment, probably more so than some of the conventional SEO metrics and stats as it stands at the moment. But there's a lot of different ways that you can measure AI and LLM visibility. Is it the number of citations? Is it your share of voice? Is it your overall visibility score or ranking? Is it the position in which you appear in the prompt result? Like there's a lot of things there. And I don't think anyone yet has truly locked on like what is the one metric that we care about. Because it sure as hell isn't going to be traffic coming from those channels. Like I think there's a big shift that's happening there. We still see decreases in like across every industry. We still see decreases in traffic and more of that traffic coming through, like conventional organic traffic coming through other routes. Now you see declines in PPC traffic volume as AI overviews eat away at the top of page on Google. So metrics, measurement, tracking, reporting in this particular space is super interesting, I would say.
And can you share something about maybe things that you tried or things that you believe in for Personio, like where you are at with measurements? Obviously, some stuff doesn't hold anymore, but what is still viable? What should people think about more? Is it self-reported attribution? Is it something like that?
Yeah, so there's a few different things, but I would say, you know, naturally caring less about traffic generally. You know, that's a big adjustment that we've made. It's like traffic is a bit of a vanity metric. We pivoted a while ago to think more about high intent traffic. So, you know, the people that have that intent to want to buy or convert. And then more generally, you know, we still care about obviously things like keyword rankings and visibility and whatnot from an SEO standpoint, but more generally just looking at, are we influencing the metrics that we care about, which is ultimately are we getting kind of MQLs and pipeline, et cetera, for the business? Like that's the stuff that we care about. The channel attribution has become slightly more fuzzy. You know, naturally you would see that people would perhaps go from an LLM platform and then either come direct to the website or maybe they Google Google through a branded term and come through organic, or they Google a branded term and come through paid. So I think naturally, like, there's more of that kind of fuzzy layer around channel specific attribution at the minute. So yeah, maybe, you know, at some point we'll look at more of that self-identified attribution, or better ways to track that. But for now, we're more focused on, yeah, are we ultimately kind of maximizing that share of voice, and are we driving the conversion that we want to?
Interesting. James, thanks so much for sharing that and all the other thoughts and, like, also background stories. Really interesting what you shared. If people want to learn more about what you do, the stuff you do at Personio, what's the best place to follow?
I would say probably LinkedIn. Like, by all means, if people are interested or want to learn more, connect with me on LinkedIn. I occasionally, probably less than I should, but occasionally I stick posts out on some of this sort of stuff as well. So by all means, feel free to follow me there.
Nice. Okay, then thanks so much, guys and girls. Go to James Ward on LinkedIn. We will obviously put the link in the description of the podcast or on YouTube. Connect with him. Please don't spam him. Only connect with genuinely interesting questions or something like that. And James, thanks so much for taking the time today. It was a pleasure. And hopefully we'll catch up soon.
Likewise, a pleasure. Thank you, Nathus.
Bye-bye, James.
See ya. Bye.